You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 20th to the 26th of February 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Holly Else and Jack Grove and Deputy News Editor John Morgan. The implications of a planned marking boycott proposed by the UCU as part of its campaign of action to protest over pay are the subject of this week's lead news story. More on that soon from Jack. John has been speaking with David Willetts, former special advisor, now director of the Higher Education Policy Institute, that's Nick Hillman. We'll hear a little bit more on that soon too. And could a consortium of retail banks offer undergraduates loans to cover tuition and maintenance? One vice chancellor is certainly floating that controversial idea, and Holly will have more on that a little bit later. But first, Jack, the splash this week is all about how academics might be penalised if they take part in a proposed marking boycott.
Yes, this is the big news this week, that UCU have announced a marking boycott to begin on the 28th of April. That's the first day of the summer term for most universities, unless they get a better pay deal. And I've been looking at how the marking boycott went in 2006, which was the last time that this action was taken. Quite a big deal at the time.
It lasted quite a while, didn't it?
It did, actually, but the speaking to some people saying that this time it could be worse for academics, because some universities in 2006 took quite a soft line and they didn't immediately begin deductions. They deferred a decision, and then actually some universities refunded the money to academics who'd been involved in the boycott. And Chris Mordew, who's head of industrial relations at Pinson Masons, he's quite a big figure in terms of advising universities. He's saying that universities are going to be taking a far harder line, and they'll be deducting 30 or 40% to start with straight away, and then some will be going up to 100%. So universities could be university academics could be losing thousands of pounds of pay.
And does that, I mean, what effect does that have? Does it put people off, or does it sort of introduce a kind of blitz spirit, we're all in this together, and maybe encourage people to take it all that further?
Well, it's hard to say at this moment, because there's been 6 days of industrial action and people have lost quite a lot of money already. But if they were to take part in a marking boycott, which that would mean quite big financial losses for quite a lot of academics, and so it'd be interesting to see how ready they are to participate in this. I spoke to Mike Larkin at Queen's University Belfast, and he said that their members were very angry and they were very much up for this boycott. It'd be interesting to see what happens over the next 2 months, whether a deal will be reached and how many people will take part in the boycott.
One of the interesting points in the story is the fact that students are paying £9,000 fees now, obviously, as opposed to 2006 when fees were much lower. So it'll be interesting to see if it does go ahead, whether any students could ask for a refund on their fees if they're not actually getting the teaching for which they paid so much money. I'm sure some people would want to ask for a refund.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think some universities actually do have disclaimers saying that they won't offer a refund in these sort of cases, but I wonder if that would stand up.
Yeah.
If they were paying for an academic term when they couldn't get their results, and they couldn't, and if people's papers aren't being marked, and they can't graduate and they can't go and find jobs, move on and do postgraduate study perhaps.
No.
So it could cause quite a lot of financial impact for students like that.
Absolutely. I know when we covered the most recent strikes, Twitter was awash with students making exactly the same point that John makes there, which is, this is what I'm paying for, why aren't I get it? And it's interesting what you said about Queen's there as well, because, I mean, in the best university workplace, we spoke to Yanis Gabriel, who's a Bath University School of Management scholar. He said that, this is the fifth strike in 35 years he's taken part in. And as far as he can tell, his perception, the level of anger here sort of seems much lower this time around. So it's interesting that different professors saying different things in terms of how it feels. But we'll watch with interest, as we do with all these issues. But John, another article this week, you've been speaking to former advisor of David Willetts, Nick Hillman, his first interview as HEPI director, and he was, I presume from your point of view, welcomingly frank.
He was. So this is Nick Hillman's first interview, as you say, in his new job as director of the Higher Education Policy Institute, which is quite a key post in the sector, given that it's a think tank that critiques government policy and nudges government and oppositions in the right direction in terms of policy and tries to make sure there aren't too many terrible mistakes in government policy. And obviously Nick used to be was a special advisor to David Willetts, so
that's bad.
One of the questions people have raised about him is he going to have sufficient kind of independence of mind to be able to critique policy when he was one of the people who created that policy.
A legitimate charge.
Yep, certainly that's one of the questions raised by the appointment. And Nick Hillman's come out saying he's not going to be a patsy, saying his first pamphlet, which is published this week, shows that's the case. And in the pamphlet, he's looking at 8 pinch points in higher education regulation left by the government's failure to introduce a higher education bill. And he's saying, he's told us that he's not going to constantly defend the status quo. I think there are problems with the status quo. And perhaps most notably, under former director Byron Bakradnir, HEPI was very critical of the coalition for underestimating the cost of the new £9,000 fee system. The government kind of underestimated the amount of loan outlay that would never be repaid by graduates, something that's known as the RAB charge. Mm-hmm. And Nick Hillman said in the interview that Barham was, he'd won the RAB charge debate, and the HEPI analysis has turned out to be correct, and even the government now pretty much accepts that. So that's kind of an admission of a mistake in government by Nick Hillman.
Put Willetts in a tricky position, maybe. His right-hand man is quick to criticise once.
Deb Willetts is no longer his employer. I'm sure he won't mind possibly sticking the knife in a bit if it's needed, if he needs to assert his independence and show he's impartial in the new role.
It's a pretty big mistake if they turn out to be very wrong, because it would mean all these reforms have actually made the system more expensive. If the RAB charge is around 48%, I think that's the figure.
That's the figure that's been pinpointed.
It will basically mean that all these changes, the £9,000 fees, haven't saved the Exchequer any money at all.
Yep, all the sort of turmoil in Parliament, all the nightmare that the Lib Dems went through, the riots and the protests on the streets, and we could in theory end up with a system that's more expensive than what went before.
No, it's all that and more tackled on page 8 this week. Holly, moving over to you. Should banks provide access to student loans, student loans and maintenance payments, rather than the government? You've been speaking to Rama Thirunamachandran, who's the Vice Chancellor of Canterbury Christchurch University. He seems to be floating that idea.
Yes, he does, and I guess this follows on from what John was just saying about the RAB charge. So if the government want to expand the higher education sector, the money's got to come from somewhere. And Rama was arguing that the sale of the pre-2012 loan book is perhaps not going to be able to sustain this growth, and he floated this idea of undergraduate loans coming from a consortium of retail banks. Now, he admitted this was a controversial idea, and he did stress that any system that is put in place would need to be agreed and underwritten by the government. So that students could borrow in a really regulated environment.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Go ahead, Jack.
It'd be interesting, given that we've just been talking about the RAB charge, which banks would want to provide a loan that that 30% of all, 30 or 40% of which would be defaulted on. So it'd be interesting to see how the government would underwrite that, because it's just not very attractive terms for any bank to lend on.
No, and the current sale of the student loan book, of course, is the bills that haven't been repaid going to private companies as well. So you have a system whereby banks are lending students money, and eventually they get bailiffs on their back as well. I dare say the NUS would have a thing or two to say about that proposal as well.
But I think Rama's comments to Holly, he is hitting on a sort of widespread concern about how the government is going to fund this policy to abolish student number controls, because obviously it's stated that the sale of the pre 2012 loans is the way it's going to happen, but that isn't going to go ahead until 2015. I think there's no certainty that it will happen, that the government will get the price it wants. So is this loan sale really going to fund the expansion of numbers? So I think this issue that's hit on in the article is going to be one that becomes more widely discussed. Banks stepping into the system.
But I think it's also, well, here's examples of the USA and South Korea, which have private loan systems. I mean, he seems to think that it works there. And he also said that the higher education participation rates in those countries are higher than they are in the UK. And I did ask him, you know, how could this work, seeing as the postgraduate loan market from the banks is sort of non-existent, but he seemed to be convinced.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll hear some other proposals as we get closer to the cap being abolished, but this one's certainly an interesting read on page 6. Before we go, we do have a second podcast out this week. Karen Shook, our books editor, interviews Danny Dorling, who's Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford, and also author of this week's Book of the Week, All That Is Solid. You find out more about that on page 46. And this week's cover feature, I should also flag up, sees David Alexander, Professor of Risk and Disaster Education at Risk and Disaster Reduction at UCL, and Ian Davis, Visiting Professor in Disaster Risk Management at a number of institutions, including Copenhagen and Oxford Brookes University, looking at why substandard work is often submitted for doctoral examination. They speculate about how much it has to do with candidates being allocated supervisors with insufficient expertise. But that's all for this week's review podcast. You can find us on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Google+. Do get in touch and let us know what you think about this week's issue. But that's all for this week's issue review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.